One of the problems for physicians and patients alike is trying to determine the organism responsible for a respiratory viral infection. Is it influenza virus or the common cold virus, such as you're hearing me right now? There are therapeutic and public health ramifications based on this answer. Health Canada has recently approved a virus-detecting test invented by a McMaster University virologist that simultaneously detects the 18 respiratory viruses and subtypes that are responsible for the majority of respiratory viral infections. I'm pleased to introduce Dr. James Mahoney, Director of the Regional Virology Laboratory at St. Joseph's Healthcare and Professor of Pathology and Molecular Medicine at McMaster University. Good afternoon, or it is good afternoon.
Hi, how are you, Barry?
I'm fine, and this is an apropos time to talk about this, given that my nose is stuffed up and I've got the cough. And reading the information about this test intrigued me because, as a practicing family doctor, we have a lot of people coming into the office where it's important, especially for people who have underlying concurrent diseases, people who have various other risk factors, to know whether you're dealing with the onset of a flu virus or influenza virus, which is certainly much more harmful to someone than a cold virus. And I'd like to ask you, before we get to the test itself, what basic science was used behind the development of the test? How were you able to achieve this?
Well, in virology, we traditionally will grow viruses and then do some tests on it and identify which virus it is. Or some viruses, if they're present in large amounts, we can detect the protein of viruses by using specific antibodies to those proteins in enzyme immunoassays. But when there's not a lot of virus present in a clinical sample, we go after the genetic material. We go after the DNA or the RNA of the virus and amplify that genetic material by something that's called polymerase chain reaction that allows us to take a certain sequence of the genetic material and amplify it like a billion times,
right,
so that there's a lot of material that now becomes easy to detect once it's been amplified that many times. And so this nucleic acid amplification methodology is what we've been using in the diagnostic virology lab for probably 15 years now, and it's becoming the mainstay of the clinical lab because it's very, very sensitive and very, very specific. So we took this genetic approach to detect the DNA and RNA of these 18 different viruses, and that's the start of the technology.
Now, in terms of, from what you're describing as a laboratory-based test, and the procedures used to try and identify these particular viral strains, as an analogy, similar to where computers used to be these large computers, and now technology improved that you're able to compact it so that it became much more usable for an individual person or a smaller lab or in a physician's office, as opposed to requiring the infrastructure of a larger lab?
Well, I don't think that's quite a perfect analogy. And this technology, although it is revolutionary in that it can detect 18 different pieces of genetic material in a single test, and instead of having to do 18 separate tests.
Right.
So it's a big advance from that point of view, but the technology is still not to the stage where you're suggesting that could be used in a clinician's or a family doctor's office yet. It will probably be there one day. We'll probably be able to do the same thing that we do in the clinical lab in a hospital setting or a reference lab today in a doctor's office, maybe in 5 or 10 years' time. But the test takes about 5 to 6 hours, and there's
right.
some hands-on steps. So you'd need a dedicated laboratory technician or a staff to run the test, and not many doc's offices have that.
Right.
But certainly the technology is going in that direction. There's a number of biotech companies in the United States that are working on new prototype devices that will do just that. They'll extract the genetic material, amplify it, and detect it within 1 or 2 hours.
I want to turn as well to the actual proportion of respiratory infections caused by viruses. And you mentioned 18 viruses that are detected in this test. Are these the 18 that account for the bulk of this proportion?
Yes. If you just look at all, take children, for example, pediatric patients, which you see a lot of in your practice, I know, about 80% of infections in young children under the age of, say, 2 or 3, 80% are due to viruses. Of those that are viruses, there are 18 or 19 different viruses. When we helped the company to develop this assay, We built it to detect all known respiratory viruses that were published in the literature at that time. And the interesting thing here is we started this in 2005, but since the year 2000, right. there has been six new respiratory viruses discovered since the year 2000. So in 7 years, we discovered six brand new viruses. One, of course, was SARS, which right. people know about. One was avian influenza, H5N1, which has been in the newspaper a lot in the last few years. And there's two new coronaviruses and a Boca virus. So there's lots of viruses that we are discovering. So the assay, as it's formulated now, detects all but one of these viruses. And the next iteration of the test that the company is working on is including that viruses. So essentially, it'll detect all known human respiratory viruses, which is important because, you know, if it misses one, right. then the question becomes, well, is it a viral cause or is it a bacterial cause?
Exactly.
And as a clinician, you know that if it's a bacterial clinical presentation, you prescribe broad-spectrum antibiotics to cover the bacteria that you think might be involved in the upper or lower tract. But if it's a virus, you don't want to give antibiotics.
Exactly.
You want to, because unnecessary and overuse of antibiotics would contribute to multi-drug-resistant bacteria, which we're all afraid of. But if it's a virus, you want to treat the virus, and some of the viruses that you deal with in your clinical practice are treatable. For example, influenza A. You've heard about Tamiflu, neuraminidase inhibitors and M2 channel inhibitors. We have some drugs that work on influenza A. So if you have a test that can distinguish and say, oh, this patient has influenza A, this patient does not have respiratory syncytial virus, another pediatric virus, then you can treat that patient with Tamiflu. So as we develop more drugs, and we don't have a lot of drugs for antiviral drugs for specific viruses, as you know. We have a humanized antibody for RSV infections in children, and that's been very effective in decreasing the number of kids that have to be admitted to hospitals. We have Tamiflu for influenza. We used to have Plaquenil, another drug for rhinovirus, the common cold, but I think it's coming off the market now because of low efficacy.
Right.
But we will be developing new antiviral drugs specifically for specific viruses. And this test, where we can break down now, yes, it's this virus or this virus, X, Y, or Z, and there's an antiviral available, it helps the clinicians treat and manage their patients appropriately.
Now, how sensitive and specific is the test?
The test although it was just approved by Health Canada last Thursday, it was approved by the Food and Drug Administration in the U.S. last January of 2008. This test is about 95% sensitive and about 99% specific. So it's more sensitive than the traditional methods that I mentioned, culture, enzyme immunoassay, and so on in the lab, and it's very highly specific. So sensitivity is important because, you know, if a test is only 60% sensitive, you're going to miss 4 out of 10 infections.
Right.
If it's 95% sensitive, you're only going to miss, you know, 1 out of 20. And no test, your listeners will probably appreciate this, no test is 100% sensitive
exactly.
and 100% specific. No test is perfect. Every test misses something and calls things incorrectly. But as technology goes, this technology of DNA and RNA amplification and detection is very, very sensitive and very, very specific.
Now, let's look at this from a clinical standpoint, and can you take us through what would be a typical patient encounter where the test would be used? How, where would the test be located? How would the sample be transported to? Would it be based in a hospital or someone comes to see their physician? The physician is saying, you know, I really have to find out if this is influenza or not. How would you approach this particular problem in a clinical situation?
Yep. Well, I'm in a tertiary care hospital in Hamilton, a 600-bed hospital with transplant patients and HIV patients and pediatric patients and the whole works. So my setting is a little bit different. This test could be run in a hospital. It could be run in a state public health lab, in a provincial public health lab in Canada, and even in some smaller clinics if you have laboratory support
right.
on the premises. So what we typically do is when a patient presents with an upper tract infection with coughing and sneezing and runny nose, we would take a nasal pharyngeal swab, which is just past the nasal cavity. It's not just a nasal swab, but we push it back a little further into the nasal pharynx. and scrape some of the cells out on a swab, and those are the cells that are typically infected by all respiratory viruses. And then that sample gets sent to the lab where the genetic material is extracted, and it gets put into this test. And the test is about a six-hour test. So for a hospital setting like my own, we can provide the results for the 18 different viruses within one day working shift, within a 7 or 8 hour shift, which is important because we have clinicians seeing these patients, you know, around the clock if you're hospitalized or even an emergency setting, which is slightly different. But in a family practice setting, which I think is more similar to your own setting, you probably wouldn't offer this test in your setting, in your office, depending on the size of your office. You would probably collect the sample and send it to a reference lab to be tested. And then you have to make that decision as a clinician. Well, how important is it to get this particular patient diagnosed and know which virus of 18 it is, or is it a virus, or maybe it's not a virus, maybe it's a bacteria. Right. And that's where the clinical acumen of the physician and the clinician comes in, because it's, you know, in the lab, we're always dealing with turnaround time. When a sample gets received in the lab, how quickly do we test it and give the result back to the clinician? Well, if you're in a setting that doesn't have the testing on site, now you've got transportation time involved.
Right.
And so as a clinician, you have to obviously appreciate the fact, well, if I take a sample and send it out, I'm not going to get the result till tomorrow. It's not going to impact on how I deal with my patient today.
Exactly.
So these types of decisions vary from setting to setting, and you appreciate that, and it's difficult. So for the average patient going to their doctor, they're probably not going to be tested by this test. This test will probably be used for the more complicated infections, or the infections in hospitals, or the chronic type of infections. People may go to respiratory medicine clinics, and they may get worked up for infections with specific viruses more so than a family doc is with his average patient.
Now, is there any place our listeners can go to get information about the test and virology in general, just information about the viruses, about how to understand what each of these things does?
Well, I talk to the lay public, as you do, on numerous occasions, and what I always do is tell people go to Wikipedia.
Okay.
If you go to the web and go to Google and put in Wikipedia, W-I-K-I-pedia, P-E-D-I-A, it brings up an encyclopedia of biology and medicine, and you can just type in influenza virus, and it'll bring up a whole 3 pages on influenza virus. And then if you just put in respiratory viruses, it'll list all the viruses and so on and so forth. So that's one way that a lay person can find some very excellent information, which is often contributed to the website by experts, and it gets updated occasionally. And then if you want more specific information, and there's some references, a bibliography usually in the bottom of these with 3 or 4 references as well, you can look at those. And then there's another site that you can go to if you want to actually go to the medical journals and look up the journals, and that's called PubMed.
Right.
And that's run by the National Library of Medicine in Washington. And that's what I use and you probably use as a clinician on a day-to-day basis when we want to find out the latest information about the newest virus on the block or the newest antiviral drug on the block. So Google and Wikipedia, you can almost find anything if you use those two search engines properly.
Dr. James Mahoney is director of the Regional Virology Laboratory at St. Joseph's Healthcare and professor of pathology and molecular medicine at McMaster University in Hamilton. And Dr. Mahoney, I'd like to thank you very much for taking the time to discuss virology and also this test. I think it's quite neat, actually, to think about this as a really good way from a public health perspective and also from, as you mentioned, a hospital-based perspective or tertiary care setting where you have patients with complicated disease where it's imperative to find out whether an infection that they have contracted is a potential pathogen that can complicate their underlying disease process. And I really appreciate the time you've taken with us today.
Well, my pleasure, Barry. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Dr. Barry Dworkin on Sunday House Call.